All right, okay, well, let's start then. Okay, well, here we are at Carton County Medic on May the 23rd. This is David Lloyd, momentarily stepping in for Fraser Geeson, the esteemed Fraser Geeson of Mindless Ones. And our guest right now is Adam Whitehall of the Kino Club in Brighton. And we're asking Adam about Lint the Movie, which is a kind of science fiction documentary about a cult science fiction writer. So, Adam, just tell us about how you got that movie and how you're involved with the with putting it on in Brighton.
Okie doke. Well, thanks for inviting me along. I'm involved with Kino Club, which is something I started off back in March. I've been working in like cinemas about 15 years, mostly as a projectionist, and I've put on events and little film societies off and on throughout the years. And I thought it'd be nice to try one out in Brighton. And I'd been along to a few events at the West Hill Hall up in Seven Dials, just up the road from the train station, and noticed that they have a really lovely big screen, pulls down from the ceiling. And they used to have a film society there, but hadn't at the time. And they were sort of asking around for sort of maybe someone to start one up again. So me and a friend put on a quite a diverse opening weekender back at the end of March. And we had our first Saturday night was all devoted to the Riot Girl movement of like the early 90s. So showed a film of mine about Huggy Bear playing in Brighton back in February 14th, 1993, I think it was, which no one has ever seen before. And we showed Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, which is like a great film that informed a lot of the Riot Girl movement. And we had a couple of bands, all the sort of like the new brigade of sort of girl-fronted pop-punk bands. And it was a great night. And the following night, I put on a very strange themed around spring, showed the classic free cinema film Win Stanley, all about Gerald Win Stanley and the Digger movement, and we had like some other short films based around it that were kind of based around community groups taking action and stuff. Well, and I showed a 1910s silent film, Flowers Evolving and Budding, which no one had ever seen before. We had like a live score to that. So two very quite interesting evenings, and we thought, well, I got very excited about this idea of, you know, trying to put on regular nights, sort of doing unusual double bills, championing kind of cult films and sort of missing gems, and theme nights. And as a avid comic book reader most of my life, you know, I've been every Thursday I'd pop down to Dave's Comics, buy the latest things, or, you know, pick up the old graphic novel and stuff, depending on my funds for that week. And I came across The Caterer by Jeff Lint via Steve Arlette. And The Caterer was one of Jeff Lint's only forays into comic book writing. And I went off to one of my local cafes, had a cup of coffee and a sarnie, and it melted my brain in a really quite wonderful, disturbed way. I thought it was equally terrifying as it was amazingly funny, and just seemed to have more ideas, and seemed to be opening more doors to a freedom of playing with words and with narrative than most of the things I've been seeing. And I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't know anything about Steve Arlette, anything about Jeff Lynn, never heard of either of them. And then kind of sort of like left it at that, kind of championed it now and then, mentioning it to people, but I didn't really do any sort of research. And then one day I was looking on YouTube and came across Steve Arlette's trailer for the movie about Jeff Lint. I thought, my God, there's a film about this, completely ties in. I've kind of really interested in putting on an evening, maybe in collaboration with Dave's Comics, and you know, show something kind of comic book sci-fi related that was new and different. And initially I had an idea that I wanted to show Super. I don't know if people are familiar with Super, which has just come out in the States.
No.
Which is like Kick-Ass, but a lot more darker and funnier and more adult.
So it's an independent movie?
Independent feature film that's come out. I can't remember the director in it, But the trailers of that looked fantastic, and I thought if I could get that for a screening in Brighton, it would be a real coup. So I did a bit of, you know, research on that, sent up some emails, but they weren't very forthcoming in getting back to me. And in fact, they didn't get back to me. So I thought, well, okay, maybe I'll just knock that ahead for now. Maybe Super will probably get a big launch here anyway, you know, because I think it's got a few big names in it.
Ray Wilson is the main.
Exactly, yeah. And Kevin Bacon's in it, and
Liv Tyler.
Liv Tyler. Yeah. And the actress from Juno as well, she's in it as well. Yeah, so it's a great film. But also, the thing with Kino Club is also to sort of, I wanted to champion more sort of like homegrown stuff, stuff that's got more of a sort of DIY, no budget thing. And there are plenty of films like that. Not all of them have that kind of insanity of ideas that sort of like me personally would kind of be interested in showing. So I was very, very excited about the fact that there was a movie about Jeff Lynne. But at the same time, I was looking at the trailer going, well, everything I know about Jeff Lynne is a kind of tiny, tiny pieces of like this creator's life. So I thought was a trailer is a fake trailer, you know, for a film that doesn't actually exist. And it could have well have been. It could have been, you know, you make a film for a movie that doesn't exist and you make the trailer encapsulate everything that would be in that movie. So I kind of thought, yeah, it doesn't exist. And various people I'd spoken to just sort of say, yeah, it probably doesn't exist either. But I'd noticed the next time I looked at it that Steve Olet himself had mentioned to somebody else who'd seen it that the film was nearly ready. So the miracle of the interweb, I tracked him down and sort of said, look, is this true? Is Lynne the movie ready for human consumption? And he said yes. And and it didn't take much to sort of say, well, I'd like to show it, you know. And so now I've got the world premiere of this fantastic film.
And how did you, I mean, Steve, you told us earlier that Steve lives just up the road in Tunbridge Wells. Did you find it easy to get in touch with him?
Yeah, well, I got in touch with him initially by email, and we've just mainly been emailing each other. He sort of, his initial thing that it's basically being edited by Electric Children, which I think is a production house over in America, and he was worried whether it would actually be complete in time for any kind of screening in the next couple of months. So he was initially sort of saying, yeah, I'd be interested in the idea, but he was sceptical about whether it would be ready in time. And then he got back to me about a week later and said, yeah, I'm pretty sure it'll be ready. So he wants to do a London screening. I think a lot of the people who are in it as sort of fans and historians of Jeff Lynne's work are London-based. A lot of comedians, musicians, comic book authors, sci-fi authors, a lot of interesting American names in there as well. Mm-hmm. So he's planning a screening up in town, which I think will be pretty popular. So I'm just dead chuffed to kind of get
the premiere.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just ask, can you tell us a bit about Jeff Lynne? Because I have to confess complete ignorance. I don't know anything about him at all.
Well, Jeff Lynne basically has discussed Jeff Lynne. He's kind of like a combination of like Ken Kesey, William Burroughs, Philip K. Dick, and he's an amalgamation of all those people who has sort of somehow been around at various pivotal points in history in a kind of zealot type way, which may give you a clue to who Jeff Lynne actually is, really. He is a zealot construction. His stuff just sort of melts the mind, really. He was involved in music in very much a kind of Captain Beefheart style way. His only real claim to fame in terms of the history books is that I don't know how to pronounce it, is it the Zabruka Super 8 footage of the JFK assassination?
Yeah.
He's allegedly there holding an umbrella in the footage, so he's gone down in history as the umbrella man on the grassy knoll. But he's not so much known for his other work. Death kind of followed him mostly through his life. There's loads of rumours of his death, most of the ones that he sort of fabricated himself. And
right, so he's kind of like a trickster kind of character.
Absolutely, yeah, kind of somebody who is a total mind bender trickster of the classic sort of absurdist myth. The film really, really encapsulates that perfectly.
And I saw a description of the documentary as a spoof documentary. So when I first read the description of it, I thought, is it really real? Is it about a real person, or is it about a fake person, the person who pretends to be somebody who doesn't actually exist?
Well, this is the thing. It's like kind of I have two ways to jump here as a promoter of this screening, and having seen it the other day, I'm fully inclined to believe that he was entirely real. everything that happened was true, but the truth really is that he is a concoction from the mind of Steve Ollett, a quite brilliant one, because I think kind of occasionally some people, you know, some writer will come along and world build. So I've been reading about science fiction books lately, and people build worlds in these things. I've never heard the term before. So he's a world builder of Jeff Lynne's creation, and there's such beautiful, meticulous care and attention that's been brought to it. Where throughout the documentary, and also it's based on two books. Steve Ollett wrote about Jeff Lynne.
Right.
One's just called Lynne, so the other one's called And Your Point Is, that goes into his entire career and work, and it is a real labour of love, and there's so many ideas in it, and it is all Steve Ollett's work,
right?
So it's from his mind,
because you said when you the first time you came across it was when you saw the caterer in Dave's Comics, but then it was Jeff Lynne and Steve Ollett was involved with it. So how was it credited, the caterer? Was it?
Steve Ollett at the top,
right.
And then it's like Jeff Lynne's the caterer.
Mm.
When I picked it up, I knew that it was, you know, just a very, very beautiful mashup of old comics that had been put together. Some sort of EC stuff. And you pointed out, Steve, a very interesting thing that you felt it maybe would have been like a 70s Christian comic that would have been sort of butchered and new stuff put in the speech bubbles and stuff, and there's I think there's probably some truth in that, you know, because it feels like it's someone's come across a very sort of obscure rubbish thing and just totally gone to town on it, and it is mental. I mean, it really is mental. I actually felt my brain moving around in my head in a pleasant and unpleasant way at the same time.
So it's a bit like Woody Allen did that movie, didn't he, where he took
What's New Pussy Willow, isn't
yeah
it?
I forget what it was called.
He just dubbed over it.
So yeah. You think it's a bit like that, or is it has some resemblance?
It has some resemblance to that, a lot of resemblance to as I said, Zelig, so another Woody Allen thing. For me, actually,
Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap is kind of classic spoof. You know, so it is a spoof of its kind. I think the nice thing with the film, which I guess the books do as well, is that you get to see sort of talking heads of some, you know, pretty well-known people, from Alan Moore to Stuart Lee to Dave Deviant, Dave Devant, I was getting his name wrong, and from his and his spirit wife, and other people like Lord Pin. As well, I'm not sure who Lord Pin is, but I quite like him, and I'm frightened of him as well.
Yeah, Mr. Solo, somebody called Mr. Solo.
Yes, I've got the names written down here actually. Bill Kectic, I think, is involved as well. A lot of kind of Bill Ekectric is involved, and Layla Johnson, Andrew O'Neill, D. Harlan Wilson, 7-inch Stitch, Robin Ince as well, who's an English comedian. There's a really nice network of people involved in it, all believing with sometimes a straight face, sometimes a bit of a smirk, and some great use of sort of archive footage. And for me, actually, because I'm a huge fan of Adam Curtis's documentaries. Do you know Adam Curtis?
Explain them for the listeners. Is that
Adam Curtis is basically, I think, he makes these sort of TV essays using archive footage, and they're real, they're not spoofs, and one's on tonight, a new series starts on BBC Two. He just writes these extremely deft, very, very good essays about the people behind the power and, you know, how sort of power is involved in everything from how Freud's teachings were used in the States to...
Did he do the Power of Nightmares?
And the series that started tonight is called Machines Watched Over by Love, with Love and Grace, which is all about... I guess the internet and sort of the rise of things like sort of Twitter and everything. I think he's like an old school propaganda filmmaker, but for the power of good, because I think he's a real truth giver. He really kind of encapsulates bits of history that I think are blanked out from us, you know, that we don't see, and he makes tremendous films. And for me, the Jeff Lint movie is like taking an Adam Curtis film and having it remixed by Chris Morris, because it's there's a real hypnotic psychedelic effect to the whole thing. It's very lo-fi, it's filmed very straightforwardly. They've obviously had you know, copyright issues in terms of what footage that they can use and so forth, so it doesn't have that kind of access which Adam Curtis has to a whole wealth of footage from archives that he sort of spins together in this kind of amazing tapestry of sort of retelling history as it should be told. But for me, that's kind of what I felt. You know, it's like sort of someone as sort of satirical and as slightly, you know, a bit of a mind gangster as Chris Morris is in things like Brass Eye and Blue Jam and everything. It's like he's gone along and remixed the Adam Curtis documentary about this chap. But it's also extremely down to earth as well, if that makes any sense. You know, it really feels like you're sort of... It's like that situation where you're sitting in a pub garden and someone who you vaguely know starts telling you an anecdote about somebody you've never heard of before, and you're just like, Jesus, I've got to know more about this person. So, you know, it's full of that kind of enthusiasm. Mm. And a lot of the talking heads are in that way. It's people's, you know, back rooms and sort of, you know, out in a park and stuff, and it's just people talking about Lint's work. And it's unbelievably funny. I think that was the thing which I knew it was going to be funny. I knew there'd be a lot of good satire in it, but really there's joke after joke after joke, and it's just utterly rich in ideas. So I'm very, very pleased to be showing it.
Well, I do see that Jeff Lint has got a Facebook page. Do you think that's real?
He's got a Wikipedia page as well. You know, but Wikipedia actually at the bottom, I think they have to stress that it's a sort of a spoof person, you know, which kind of I think defeats the object a bit really, because just sort of I think there should be more fake people, you know, particularly if they've done such great things as Jeff Lint.
Well, there was a few group identities that were set up in the 60s, wasn't there? There was Karen Elliott, and anyone who wanted to could call themselves Karen Elliott, and there was a producer magazine called Smile, and there were like hundreds of issues of it, by all different people, different sexes all over the country, different ages. And Monty Can't Sin, I think, was another one. There was articles in a magazine called Vague in the 80s about a lot of things like that, group identities. So,
Alan Smithy's the classic for the cinema. Which is the name that anyone puts on if a director disowns the film.
Yeah.
They put Alan Smithy on it.
Mm. I actually made a film about that.
Yeah.
Called I'm Alan Smithy. And I think Eric Idle was involved. And that the director that was involved fell out so badly. He actually asked for his name to be removed from the credits.
That's
I was genuinely credited as an Alan Smithy film.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that happened to Don Siegel. Don Siegel, the great American director, is... he did a movie called Death of a Gunfighter, and he wasn't happy with the cut, the studio cut. So that's assigned to Alan Smithy.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah, it's not. Well, it doesn't seem bad to me, but I mean, you know, Don Siegel wasn't very happy with it, and he should have been happy with it.
I love that whole concept with creating Jeff Lint is that he almost becomes real through the sort of the belief, even though everyone perhaps knows or doesn't know that he's real, it kind of brings him to life almost. It creates something that wasn't there originally.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're right, he creates as him, doesn't he? Because the caretaker is created by
Jeff Lynne. Yeah.
And this is the Portuguese poet that I was banging on about, Fernando Pessoa, who wrote under these heteronyms, which weren't pseudonyms, they were people he created. And he used to write as them, so when he would change his name for each style because he would inhabit this person and write through them. One was very Christian, one was very pagan, one was this, one was that. Do you know what I mean? And it's almost that, isn't it? It's the trickster kind of gimmicky, not real, fake biography, but at the same time, it's a vehicle, isn't it? So for him to create in a way he couldn't.
I believe Max Sweeney's, the American publishers, they put together an entire book about 6 or 7 issues ago, and it was all based along those lines, just sort of fake books, but made by sort of real people who ought to exist, and then sort of biographies about those people as well, looking into their lives, and I guess it's a little Borges thing as well. I think he kind of did a lot of that sort of thing. Yeah, I think it's something personally always I did this weird thing actually halfway through the film, because I'd sort of been drinking wine and eating Bombay mix, and the wife had gone to bed, bless her, she was enjoying it but she'd got a bit tired, I thought I'll go and have a ciggy break out of the kitchen window, and while I did I sort of picked up a magazine to read while I was there, and it was the latest issue of Little White Lies, and it was all about Apocalypse Now, and I just started reading this interview with Walter Merck, who I really like his take on his career and filmmaking in general, and the whole thing had completely changed. It was like I'd been given a Jeff Lynne drug, because suddenly him just chatting about his involvement in Apocalypse Now was just sort of like, this is complete fabrication. Apocalypse Now doesn't exist. There's this person as far as I saw Coppola. Do you know what I mean? And it was also like all of this was created by Jeff Lynne, and it was like it was like a porthole to the universe. It was crazy. So kind of, I just put the magazine down and just stared out of the window, kind of like, will life ever be the same again?
Do you think there is an element of that, of what Robert and Wilson would call guerrilla ontology, that it's about, he's like, that Steve Ayers, presupposing, but perhaps he's being disruptive, he's being subversive in doing this, in that he's questioning the existence of there being any kind of such thing as a person or an individual or an identity, or there being such thing as as fact.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? People that are authorities are found, this happened like this and all that, and you always find out when you look into it, the historians or the newspapers are actually misleading you slightly. Do you think there's an element of that to it, that
absolutely.
He's trying to provoke that kind of reaction where you think, shit, nothing's real. I'm a double agent in my own spy film.
Well, it's two coins. I think at one side there is actually kind of a serious attempt to seriously monkey with the universe and monkey with the authorities that be, who put forward what, received notion of history is and facts. And it's just sort of turning that on its head and doing it in a very kind of like complete way. And on the other side of it is this sort of down to earth thing that kind of like, the way you find out about these things is just through sort of someone down the pub telling you a story, and it kind of, it could be true, it couldn't be true,
This is something that, it reminds me of Holographic Universe too, that book?
No.
I don't know who the author is, I was recommended it, and it's about, it describes the possibility that everything we exist doesn't really exist. It's a hologram.
Mm.
Our perceptions are really... are filtered through various mental states, and nothing that we experience actually does exist. It's all a hologram, and you have to get the book to understand it. It covers everything from mediumship to psychic healing, the whole thing.
Mm.
And it's quite fascinating. It really questions everything that we've come to believe is true. Are real. It covers that whole element of what is dream and what is reality, which is always something that's interesting, because I've had dreams that are incredibly lucid, and when at the moment you dream them, you think, my God, it's real, but of course it isn't. It's just your mental state at that time. So I guess that's part of it. Or do you think?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of that to it. I mean, I personally spent huge portions of my life keeping sort of, I guess, were sort of dream journals. But I would like, I'd be so kind of inspired by a particular dream. I mean, used to, back in the day, remember them a lot more vividly than I do now. And I'd write them out, and they would just be stories. And I remember I did an experiment once where I had a dream involving a couple of friends of mine. And I remember going up to one of them and sort of saying, "Oh yeah, me and Lisa were doing this thing the other day, and this thing happened in HMV, and she was attacked and stuff." And he freaked out. Was going, "Oh." And so I deliberately didn't tell him it was a dream until afterwards. And it was quite a strange experience, really, because I was telling him something that, you know, that I had a part in inventing while asleep, but, you know, that hadn't. Well, but most of the elements of it were real enough to be sort of believable. So it wasn't like it was a lie, like I'd made it up. It was just sort of something that I'd kind of seen some window to.
And you pretended it was real, sort of like just a playful mischief.
Yeah, just as a bit of mischief. Because it's kind of like there's nothing more boring than saying to somebody, "Oh, I had this dream this morning."
Yeah.
Because everyone just switches off, you know, no matter how many famous people are there. All car chases.
Right, sure.
the Alan Moore book got coming out, and there's a really interesting bit in there where his epiphany with all of that was to say, well, if it exists in my head, then it's real.
Yes.
You know, so if whatever you can imagine, then it exists.
Yeah.
And it's real. And just because it's not out here in this reality, it's real in there. So that makes it real.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite an interesting view on the world.
Yeah, that's that whole thing. That's where you got that thing. I, whilst living, have conquered the universe. That whole thing. That's why I'm so attracted to that whole thing.
But the film reminded me a little bit of F for Fate, Orson Welles' film.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Very funny you say that, actually, because
Oh no, I'm sorry. I haven't seen Lynch. Sorry, no.
Oh, what film?
But the sound of it reminds me.
Oh,
very
right.
Much
I'm sorry.
Of that kind of concept.
If he had, he would have been world gold.
I have to say, I thought that as well. I kind of thought they'd make quite an interesting double bill somewhere down the line. Because that's another film which is just really sort of spot on with that kind of creating, you know. Because again, it's that Alan Moore thing of like sort of, you know, the idea space that we all sort of share, and that, you know, and the more real that you sort of tap into that, the more kind of like you can go, oh yeah, that's
if the more people that believe in the existence of Jeff Lynne, the realer he becomes.
Yeah,
it's like it's kind of 1984. As well, isn't it? Like the Ministry of Truth, where you sort of say, right, well, this has happened, so let's pick someone and say, oh, he did this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that was him in that picture there, and that was him, and there's a brood of footage and everything. And if you just keep sort of circling faces in a crowd, you'll eventually get people to believe that was the same person that appears every
day. Yeah, and it's about thought police. The thought is as real as the crime itself.
Yeah. It's a kind of, the internet's doing its own sort of versions of this thing now. Where I've noticed people are starting posting the new, I can't remember the actor's name, but the chap at the moment is playing Doctor Who.
Matt Smith,
yes, who possibly my favourite Doctor of all time now, I think. They're placing him in historical moments. I saw a great picture of him at the royal wedding recently, and it's photoshopping, but it's kind of like photoshopping for the good of mankind, I think. You know, it's just a great idea of,
because they did a bit of that on the show,
so
people have just taken it further.
Yeah.
But people do that on Facebook. They say things like, "Went to a great party this afternoon," where in fact they just were at home, but they want to make it look like their life is more interesting. Yes.
That's true.
There's a real phenomenon.
Yeah. It's maybe a cure for loneliness, then. It's kind of this
the adoption of persona.
Yeah, exciting life, and people should be friends with them.
But tell me, you're obviously interested in sort of imagery and reality.
Yeah.
And obviously you're interested in movies, which is the same kind of thing. Tell us more about the Kino Club then, because you just introduced us briefly to the Kino Club. Tell me more about it, and you must spend a lot of time working on it.
Well, as I say, it's still very much in its infancy, because it's, you know, I did this weekend in March. I did have a proposed night in April, which was coming really hot on the heels of the first two nights. And I thought, no, actually, I'm gonna postpone it for the time being, just to sort of, you know, and make it, you know, give it a bit more impetus. It's the deal with any kind of like I think film more than anything else. I think anything that's kind of sort of literary based, you can sort of set up upstairs at a pub, and you know, you can, like we're doing now, and you know, you can get people coming, word of mouth spreads, and it's good because it's kind of sort of free and it takes care of itself. You know, cinema's a tricky beast because, you know, you put together a film society, and I'm good friends with the people who run the Lewis Film Society, and they put on a cracking bill of about 12 to 14 films a year, in fact more than that, I think, and they pick mostly new films. There's a lot of world cinema that kind of slips through the net that people don't often get a chance to see, whereas in the same space there's the Lewis Cinema that kind of runs the sort of regular, you know, latest releases, so they'll be showing like, you know, King's Speech and so forth, and it, in my mind, I've always, you know, I've kind of gone through my life like writing in notebooks, you know, just reminding me of films I've just seen once, you know, 2 o'clock one afternoon and stuff that have really, you know, had an effect on me. I've got to try and hunt that film down. I want to share that with other people. So for me, having the space at the West Hill Hall is an opportunity to do that. But it's not going to be just kind of like my own film tastes, because that would be rude. But I want it to be more inclusive to the community. So I'm sort of putting together a bit of like a steering group of, you know, people who'd be interested and stuff. And but basically come, I think once summer's over, come September, I want to sort of do like, you know, a screening every week up there. And there's the opportunity to do that. And so, you know, and that would be quite varied as well, because I mean the film that I was going to show in April is a very, very obscure 1950s British children's film called Innocent Sinners that very few people have ever seen, that I've managed to get Park Circus and the ITV archives to make me an actual DVD copy of, which I'm really pleased about. And I'm going to show some sort of short films of sort of, you know, children's short films from around that period, and put together a proper package and have like sort of talks and stuff. So every night's going to be quite unique in itself, you know. I'm a big fan of the Long Island filmmaker, Hal Hartley, who was making a lot of stuff, great, great comedies during the 90s. Nobody ever mentions him now. It's like he never existed.
He was really hot at the time.
Absolutely.
Everyone raved about him. Yeah, yeah. He has just disappeared.
He kind of came around the same time as Kevin Smith and Spike Lee, and was just made great, great films. And, you know, with just a bit of research and kind of paying for sort of license fees and everything, I put on a double bill of Hal Hartley at the thing. So it's this real feeling of excitement that kind of like, you know, all this wealth of cinema that appears and then vanishes, or sort of becomes a bit culty, or just people know through DVDs and, you know, old hidden video copies you've taped off the telly, you know, and sort of, you know, put it on. But also I'm kind of keen to have like a live element to it as well, where you have like symposiums and talks and stuff as well.
Describe the space. How much seating do you have? And
there's between, like, it's not huge, it's between about 80 and 100 capacity sitting, you know, and it's a real sort of relaxed space. To be honest, it's really strange. It's like you go down this little pathway just opposite the West Hill pub, and there's this hall there. You go into the hall, and it's like time travelling back to some kind of village,
it's like,
village fate,
a
you know.
Cartoon pub,
oh right,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually,
he should. Oh, we should get him involved in the thing.
But he's a member of the club, the bloke who runs the club. So it's who I was talking about last time. Is that West Hill? But it is. It's like some 1950s
yeah.
hall. Isn't
it's
it?
Lovely. It's kind of it's sort of got these, got a stage there, tatty red velvet curtains, you know, comfy seats, which is handy for cinema events.
And a big screen.
And I'm borrowing a projector from the Duke of York's. It is a nice space. And when we sort of did the first two nights, it was great because we could kind of have, you know, because we were having bands as well. You know, we have the bands on the stage and everyone's like looking that way watching the film. And then they turn around and they watch the music, you know. So there's a, you know, people have to move around a little bit, which is useful. So it's just a cracking little space. It feels very time displaced, I feel. You know, it does feel like it's
yeah,
from the 40s
or
50s.
Yeah, but in
that
lane as well, it's yeah. a bit of time travel.
That sounds like a good space to watch films.
especially if they're not there as well, actually, because you can rent it out really cheaply, I believe.
You did say something about showing silent films with live scores to that's coming back again. I saw Metropolis a while ago, and there's a band, I've forgotten their name, but they specialise in doing the soundtrack to silent German expressionist films. I saw them do Caligari a while ago.
I saw them do Caligari. It's very good.
Is it the Prince of Wales Theatre in London? Yeah. It was great. Oh, it's one of my favourite films ever, so you know everything that's happening, but the way they did the music to it, there was a lot of humour in what they were doing, and they almost had Peter Gunn-esque sort of 50s surf beat type thing while they're running across the rooftops, and it just worked so well.
They did a very, very good score, I thought, to it.
Yeah.
I've seen others that haven't worked so well. I think when it first started happening, that kind of thing, the previous cinema I worked at, they did an event where they showed Run, Lola, Run, and they had this, I think it was the Bays, did this real sort of thunderous, good techno score to it, which works in places, but it was to a film that has dialogue in it and has other sound going on in it. So you sort of wipe all that off. It doesn't matter. Subtitles sort of become kind of meaningless in a way, because you're getting the gist of the story, but you've just got continuous music on top of it, so there's no real room to breathe.
That's weird. So somebody, they did a, they Run Lola Run has got a score, has got a, it's yeah. a, you can buy it, but they did a special score for this?
Like a live score.
That's weird.
Yeah, and it's very, it's a popular thing to do. I think it's kind of, I thought the Caligari one really works. Yeah. I've got friends in Brighton, actually, who are going to do a special live score to Vampira.
Oh.
I can't remember the director, same guy made Joan of Arc.
Oh, Carl Dryan.
Yeah.
Vampire.
Yeah. And we're doing that probably later in the year. And they're amazing. They are exactly the right musicians to do it. And there's like a piano in the venue as well. They don't really have a name. They're just sort of, there's sort of three or four musicians I know who just sort of work together. They've done like two or three CDs, but they just kind of, they just sort of self-sell them around. But I don't actually think they have a name that they go by. They will have by the event, but they're really good for doing a soundtrack to that.
So where do you advertise these events?
The usual way, really. I mean, this the sort of the Limp one I've just started promoting now. So we've got there's the sort of the West Hill Kino Club blog spot, which just kind of has got all the information on it. There's a Facebook thing as well. So if you just put West Hill Kino Club in there, you'll find us. And the usual other ways, posters and flyers and stuff. Usually sell tickets, the week got tickets. There's quite a few, local outlets in Brighton that are quite, helpful in promoting it. It's quite interesting though, because, the ones that normally will sell tickets, they're record shops. So for the first two events, because there was a live music element to it as well, it's kind of a shoo-in for them to say, okay, we'll sell tickets for you. But it's kind of interesting for sort of future ones, because they might not necessarily have live music. So I'm not sure whether places like Resident Records and Rounder Records will kind of go, well, yeah, we'll sell tickets to a cinema event. But they might do, I don't know.
What's the dates of the Limp premiere?
The 26th of June. So Sunday the 26th of June.
I heard a great story about the Salvador Dali, Louis Buñuel film and Chien Andalou. Apparently when they first screened that, they just rented out a small cinema where they lived, and they borrowed old gramophones, the wind up ones, off people that they knew, just picked six records at random, and they were behind the screen just sort of spinning the records across and just randomly going backwards and forwards.
Wow.
To make the music to their own film, which was, a really unusual thing to do then. But, that would be something quite nice to create with Chien Andalou. I mean, I don't know if you'd be able to get gramophones in 68.
Yeah, some gramophones,
yeah.
Really mashup.
Yeah, I know, first ever DJ set with called Dali and Louis Buñuel. I mean, nothing's original, is it?
Yeah. I did a DJ set of cinema during the Duke of York's 100th birthday celebrations, where I was basically using YouTube clips and music and some stuff. It was all on the laptop and things. And we did that I really enjoyed doing that. It was a kind of, took me ages to kind of source all the material, but it was this sort of notion of kind of like, can you create a sort of believable soundtrack that people could just listen to itself? And like, you know, I had like some sheets listing some of the stuff I was playing, and it worked really well. I think my favourite bit was playing a clip of you know, the film Deliverance,
yeah,
with the dueling banjos. I played that on top of the scene from Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker battling each other. And I'd only ever done it twice. I did it as a kind of experiment at home. I thought, this is incredible. And then I did it in the cinema. So kind of, you imagine the whole auditorium's there, and people are coming and going on tours of the cinema. So it wasn't sort of necessarily conducive for people sitting down and listening. And people weren't seeing the images. They could only just sort of hear. And that went down really, really well. You know.
That sounds really good.
And also playing the sound of old projectors and airways and stuff.
So, I mean, you said that someone's getting you a DVD copy of things. Is it you're showing DVDs projected, or is it actual cine film?
The option is that, well, I mean, for ease, like everything we showed the first week, that was all DVD. But there is 16mm projectors there, and I've got Super 8 projectors and 16mm projectors, so it is possible to show that. And I think as things progress, it might be nice to have a kind of regular evening that is just about showing film itself. Because I think that would be really nice. You know, and also having things where maybe those would be the nights where you have like live scores. I'd quite like to do like a kind of live score to a film workshop, where you just have instruments lying around and you invite people just to jam to a film. Another idea, which I think would be a regular event, would be a sort of VHS archive night, where people come down with a sort of queued up VHS tape, which has got adverts on it, you know, from like, you know, 1986 or something. You know?
Oh, I've got lots of those.
Yeah, and it's just that everyone's got it, and I just sort of think, you know, you kind of have a thing where it's a sort of VHS show and tell. You put the tape in, say, okay, this is, you know, five things on top of each other that kind of are just all, you know, mashed together from like 1991, you know, and I think all that stuff's really watchable. I myself have a very, very strange thing, which is I left the tape recording a film, went to bed, and in the morning realised it had taped all the CFAX afterwards. And in the CFAX, which is obviously the CFAX pages scrolling up, one of them in that old kind of old computer style, little modern jazz on top of it, like Princess Diana may have been injured in a car accident in Paris.
Wow.
Then another page a few minutes later, Princess Diana may be dead, you know, and it was very weird. So you've got this kind of real time, old fashioned news feed of this, you know, kind of like big historical event, you know, with this jazz playing on top of it as well. It's my favourite element of it.
Because now you only find out that someone famous is dead when you get the texts about it.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Two tweets, yeah. 4 o'clock in the morning, you're sort of thinking, I'm getting texts about Michael Jackson.
The scariest thing I've got on video, because, you know, I used to tape movies, and you get the news after it. And you're getting news about Margaret Thatcher and Norman Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's like, thank God. You know, it's like, you know, news from some dark period that you somehow survived through. And, you know, it's horrible. All these images of Margaret Thatcher and Norman Taylor. frightening. Really frightening. but that's it, you know, it's... How do you actually finance the Kino Club? I mean, you're putting on all these things. How does it work financially?
I think that's a work in progress. I mean, like,
oh, right.
The first two events were interesting because, well, particularly the second night, because I was showing two things from the BFI and just a little bit, you know, about the finance of that. The feature film I was showing, Win Stanley, which is it's not a terribly known film, but it's part of the BFI archive. In order to do this all legitimately, and legitimately means that you can then promote it to the hilt, you know, if someone from the BFI notices that you're showing something without permission, you're going to get in serious trouble. So to show that, that was £90 for one screening of that. To get anything from the BFI that's under I think either 40 minutes or even 20 minutes. It's a lot cheaper, so it'd be like sort of £20. I had like the film of all the 1910s flower film of all the flowers and time lapse. That only cost me like £20. But showing that, and then I had like a musician performing live to it, you know, it was like just a big broad grin on my face just straight afterwards. It was kind of like, okay, I picked that, I picked the musician, they went together so beautifully, you know, and I was really pleased. So immediately with kind of like, you know, it's a community hall, any money that they make goes straight into the upkeep of the hall. So you know, you have to support that. So there's a fee to the hall, and then there's the, you know, whatever fees, like any event, you know, but it kind of builds up. So at the moment, for the first two nights, any money's made were just through ticket sales. Mm. You know, and then we did okay. You know, Saturday night, the Riot Girl night, did extremely well. Sunday night, pretty much broke even. Have the obligatory bar there as well. And, you know, I had people donating cakes and stuff, and you know.
Right, so there's a bar there.
Well, there isn't. You can bring your own bar to it. You know.
Bring your own bar.
Yeah, the hall doesn't have a drinks license, but you can. For future events, I'm applying for one. Most of the events that sort of kind of go on there, I think, kind of, well, apart from parties, I think they will usually apply for a drinks license. You can apply for drinks license and do that. So it's a very good space to do things at. It's kind of, it's got, you know, got a good series of rules that you need to follow, which is great. But it's not very, there's room for manoeuvre, and there's sort of, there's a lot of support from the people who run it. Leanne Hall is the main kind of custodian of the place, and she's very supportive. And it's got a, you know, I mean, it's got a great feel of being part of the community and stuff as well. So again,
it's really like a village hall.
Yeah.
They kind of push on the comics events there or something, bringing it back to
yes.
cartoons. But I mean, you know, it sounds like a really good place to kind of present work and,
well, I think one
talk
of
through it and so on.
My initial idea, which hopefully will happen, I think for the Sunday, the same day as the limp things, that I wanted Steve from Dave's Comics to help me put together like a kind of a panel talk. And that still might happen, but you know, I'm kind of keeping relatively quiet about that until we've got all the sort of details. Yeah. So that would be kind of like, you know, afternoon, early evening, and then the Lint film in the evening. Yeah. So have a kind of, you know, in classic sort of British summer annual tradition, sort of make it also a bumper summer package of, you know, comic book related treats, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, and I like to be theme events type thing, you know, and I sort of maybe getting a bit too ambitious and try and cram too much in, but the space is perfect for kind of running, you know, like a regular comic cartoon related events there. I think that would really support it as well.
Well, I think that's thanks for telling us all about that, and I should say that we've just been joined by Sean Duffield, who has produced War of the Human Cost, which everybody knows is this great book about anti-war stories, which is now available for sale. So do you want to just say something about this, Sean? What do you just write?
Yeah, the blood is finally finished.
Yeah, it's finally finished.
4.5 years of getting together, so yeah.
Okay, so
it's out there. I haven't managed to get it in the shops or anything yet, but I think I've sent the mail out. It's on Amazon now, and I brought some copies with me. So yeah, I'm pleased with it. It looks great. It was always, when you get something going to the printers, it's always a little bit kind of, you're hoping it's going to look as good as you want it to, and yeah, I'm quite pleased with it. So far, the responses have been pretty good. So, yeah, it's out there.
This is for podcasts. You can say how people will be able to get copies and get in touch with you.
I'm trying to set up a WordPress site, but I'm not very web literate, so a friend's going to help me with that. But in the meantime, it's if you search what are the human costs on Amazon, turns up on Amazon, or alternatively, so you can just email me on seantiger@googlemail.com, and I can just sort something out over any, if anybody wants to buy a copy. And of course, yes, CD with that as well. So.
Okay, and
that's my plug.
Right, and we also have to mention that if you're a part of the Cartoon County Network,
right, special discounts.
You get a special discount. So
I think it's for £10, isn't it? Yeah, Cartoon County members. So it's £12 in the shops.
Well, there you go. So everybody listen to that. So, anybody have any last questions for Sean or Adam about the movie and Kino Club?
What time is it? Not now. I mean,
it's about 8 o'clock. Start the doors are open. It's a very good question.
Where am I?
The doors are at 7, and the tickets are £5. Five special Earth pounds, so it's quite reasonable as well.
And you have a website too, Adam?
Yeah, just the Blogspot thing at the moment, because like yourself, I'm not terribly web literate, and that's the only thing I can kind of create at the moment. But again, a friend of mine is going to help me put together a proper Kino Club website, and we'll sort of archive things. The Blogspot thing's been quite good, because there's been lots of, you know, it's a bit like, I've become like Mr. Ben. Everywhere I go outside of my door, everything I see seems to be related back to running a little cinema club, which is quite nice.
Will Steve Ayluck be there?
Yes, that's the other thing. That's a good thing to mention. Steve's going to come down and he's going to be introducing the film. He may bring a couple of the people who took part in it. Stuart Lee was interested in coming down, but it's just sort of like literally the day after he'd come off to a huge tour and stuff. I don't think Alan Moore will be there, strangely.
You should say that you will, because then you can turn
Alan down. Moore's going to be there.
Yes. Oh dear, he turned down.
But Steve Ollett reckons there might be a few other
and
people from the...
Mr. Lynn himself.
Mr. Jeff will be there, in the back, sniggering.
You can't prove he isn't.
Exactly.
Watch out for that umbrella. Yeah.
The umbrella man will be serving beer.
Okay, well, that seems like a perfect place to finish the podcast. And just want to say thanks, Adam, for coming on and telling us about that. So thanks. Big round of applause for
having me.
And to say thanks to Sean for just turning up at just the right moment to just what the human cost. So thanks to Sean.
Exactly. Well, by popular request from David Lloyd, I have to tell you that my name is Corinne Pullman, and I've just bought a copy of War, the Human Cost, which is an anthology edited by Sean Duffield, and it's absolutely brilliant. And we've just told you all about it before, so I'm not going to repeat the details, but it's worth it. It looks really, really great. And I also wanted to tell you about the first graphic novel competition, which Myriad Editions is running at the moment. And it's the closing date is 1st of October, and I would love anyone who is working on a graphic novel or thinks they might be working on a graphic novel or would like to work on a graphic novel in whatever shape, form, to have a look at the entry conditions at myriadeditions.com, first graphic novel competition, and you'll see all about it. So please do that, and I have got loads of postcards and things to give away about it. So if you think you know where you might like to distribute it, please do.
Corinne Pullman, where can we find the information for this competition?
I thought I just said.
Did you just say that?
Yes.
Perhaps I was saying goodbye to someone.
Yeah, at www.myriadeditions.com/FGNC. That's it.
Hooray! Hey. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I have a horrible feeling I may have been bibbling, you know.